Now the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Monday edition of the Three Martini Lunch. Jim Garrity of National Review is on the National Review cruise. So Daniel Foster of National Review Online, he's the news editor for the website, joins us in Jim's stead. And with so many folks on the cruise, Dan can pretty much put whatever he wants on the website this week, and it'll take hours, if not days, for anybody to figure out what he's done. So, Dan, that, you must enjoy that fact.
That's right. Look for a lot of Justin Bieber content.
On to the good martini today. And, Dan, this might be the least surprising story we've ever done on any of these martinis, but shock of all shocks, the Supreme Court is going to take up the case of Obamacare and decide whether the individual mandate in particular is constitutional or unconstitutional, and who knows what other aspects they may decide to delve into, but that's the main question before them. And basically for the last 3 years, this is the time we've been waiting for. We're expected now to hear arguments in probably March, an unprecedented 5.5-hour oral session here, so who knows how far this this case could go in front of the court. As we mentioned a few months ago, pray that the five justices who could be rational on this are still healthy and well when all of this takes place. But this is what we wanted. So great, it's here.
Policy-wise, my expert opinion as the varsity runner-up for the Bergen County, New Jersey High School Mock Trial Association, that my expert opinion there is that I really do think Justice Kennedy, who's obviously the swing vote here, his stated philosophy is tie goes to freedom. That's kind of the slogan that he gives for his jurisprudence. And I think that if I had, you know, a gun to my head, I'd say he would rule narrowly against the individual mandate and maybe even against this Medicaid expansion, which is the other part of it, this unfunded mandate, which seems to step all over the principles of federalism. But the amazing thing about Obamacare is that there's this huge unfunded Medicaid mandate, and it's the 11th most important thing we're talking about because the bill is so bad. But that's, you know, another aspect that the court's going to look at. And if, like I said, if I had to guess, I'd say that we'd get a 5-4 decision that narrowly rules that the mandate is unconstitutional. Real open question what the court's going to try and do about it, whether they're going to strike down a piece of the law or the whole law. That's a big part of the oral arguments they'll be hearing, is the severability of the mandate from other aspects of the law. Politically, I don't know what the effect is going to be. Jennifer Rubin at the Washington Post argued that it's not going to be much of a factor in the primary, that we're not going to get a decision until after we have a nominee, and that in the general, she thinks that it'll be bad for President Obama either way. And I tend to agree with that. I mean, I think if it's upheld, it will rally the Republican base and the majority of Americans who oppose this bill in a way you haven't seen. And I think if the bill struck down, it's obviously a huge blow to the centerpiece of President Obama's first term. So I think the fact that we're going to have a decision is bad for President Obama. I hope we get the right decision for the future of our republic, but I think politically, the Republicans can take advantage of it either way.
And as the district judge down in Florida said, if you take out the individual mandate, the whole house of cards falls down because you'll never have enough money to pay for all this. And so even if the court does rule narrowly, then you'll probably have a good chance of watching this all fall apart. I just hope that it doesn't end up being an explanation among Democrats that, well, we tried this halfway approach, and I guess a public option's the only way to go now. I'm sure that'll be their rationale if, in fact, this doesn't work. But one step at a time. Let's hope the justices get this right. So on to martini number two now, and I don't usually watch a lot of 60 Minutes during the football season, Dan, but I did happen to catch a little bit of this one. Steve Croft was doing the report, and he's basically profiling this new book by Peter Schweitzer, who's, for the most part, pretty conservative, but he goes after Republicans and Democrats in this book for basically taking advantage of insider trading, because there are no rules for congressmen on their investments when it comes to acting on information that's not in the public domain yet. So he included both of the leaders of parties in the House, John Boehner and Nancy Pelosi. Boehner made some money on healthcare stocks just days before and after the public option was taken off the table. And Nancy Pelosi made a whole lot of money on Visa stock while the House dithered on credit card reforms. And just take a listen to the two leaders' response to this. They didn't give actual interviews, but Croft went to their weekly briefings and got answers. Here's first Boehner's reaction to the healthcare stocks.
I have not made any decisions on day-to-day trading activities in my account. And haven't for years. I do not do it. Haven't done it. I wouldn't do it.
You may believe him, you may not, but he's got a pretty coherent answer there. Not so on the Democratic side. Here's Nancy Pelosi.
only has appearance if you decide that you're going to have elaborate on a false premise. But it's not true, and that's that.
I don't understand what part's not true.
Yes, sir. I would act upon an investment. Yes,
Congresswoman Pelosi pointed out that the tough credit card legislation eventually passed, but it was 2 years later and was initiated in the Senate.
I will hold my record in terms of fighting the credit card companies as a Speaker of the House or as a member of Congress up against anyone's.
Fabulous non sequitur there. I've been tough on the credit card companies, never mind the fact I've made money to the equivalent of $20 a share just days after I bought the stock. Way to stay on topic there.
This whole story stinks. I'm glad that Schweitzer's book is pointing attention toward it. Megan McArdle at The Atlantic had a really interesting and provocative take on it. I think in the very least, what Schweitzer recommends is right, that members of Congress, just like the President of the United States, should have all their assets put in a blind trust. It sounds a little extreme, but I think the real solution from a conservative point of view is, guess what? Have a Congress that can, you know, move markets less based on what they do. The ideal state of the Republic is one in which you're never going to completely eliminate it, but in which members of Congress don't have tremendous powers to affect economic outcomes. If the federal government were smaller and weaker, especially when it comes to commerce and money, then this conflict of interest wouldn't be as big a problem. But seeing as how we're a long ways away from the small government utopia, I think the thing that we should do is reduce sitting members of Congress's incentives to behave in these ways and to act on non-public information. As to the speaker, current speaker versus the former one, that's verifiable. When Speaker Boehner says that he hasn't made day-to-day decisions on trades, if you were really interested in verifying that, that's verifiable. I have a lot of trouble thinking that he would misspeak or try and be Weasley there intentionally, because, you know, you can follow up on that sort of thing. And that's basically, I think, the way it should work. I think you should put your money with a trusted advisor and not necessarily have access to day-to-day decisions, so long as you're serving in the United States government. Nancy Pelosi, I mean, I thought that the Democrats were supposed to be the smart, articulate ones. That answer made Rick Perry look like Ronald Reagan.
I think you're right, and I think your solution to this overall, because there were plenty of examples on both sides in this book, and several of which were mentioned on the broadcast, the Republican side, Spencer Baucus, you've got Denny Hastert back when he was Speaker of the House. On the Democratic side, it's almost legendary what Dick Durbin did at about the same time that the implosion happened in 2008, and basically dumping all the stock he had in these companies that were about to implode. And apparently John Kerry did some of that as well. But making it so that Congress doesn't have access to manipulating policy and therefore the markets, I think, is definitely the way that the founders would appreciate it, and probably the bulk of Americans as well. And they'll have a chance to make that statement pretty clear next year in terms of just how much government they want in their lives. So martini number three now. And, you know, if there's anything people want to do on a Saturday night, Dan, it's watch another Republican presidential debate, or any presidential debate for that matter, especially when it's going up against major college football. Nonetheless, because I was perfectly content with Michigan's win and didn't want to hear another word about Penn State, I decided to tune in and basically got the Scott Pelley show. He was very much watching the clock and would cut people off mid-sentence to make sure that they didn't say another word once the red light went on. There are a couple of fun instances as the time became an issue. First, Mitt Romney apparently only got 30 seconds instead of 60, and Pelley had to eat a little crow here.
That's the time, finally, Governor, on the question. Well, we're going to adhere to time
very
quickly.
Seconds.
But let me,
I get 60 seconds.
Yes, sir. And
that
60,
was 30.
The 60.
Sorry, it started at yellow, so I have much more time to go.
You know what, Governor? I stand corrected.
Well, that was about the only time Pelley gave any ground, because he really went after the folks who don't get a lot of time anyway in the debate. Apparently Ron Paul spoke for only 90 seconds the entire night. Bachman was not happy with her time, and Santorum I don't think was very happy either. But here's Michelle Bachman in the later stages of the debate. Lindsey Graham, a senator from South Carolina, had asked a question from the audience. Ron Paul had talked about why he thinks that Guantanamo Bay and enhanced interrogation is unconstitutional, presidentially ordered assassinations, which is obviously a major debate right now. And so you'll hear the applause from the Ron Paul supporters and then Michelle Bachman trying to get in.
Could I interject, Governor, and say something?
There's actually a system at work here with regard to the senator's question. So if I may, Governor Perry, you have 1 minute for Senator Graham's question.
Yeah, there's a system. We don't think you're really in this thing, so we're not going to let you talk very much. And, you know, it's interesting. You got the podium placement now with the people pulling the highest in the middle. And obviously, it makes sense on some level to give a little more time to the people who have a better shot of winning the nomination. But the way that this went down on Saturday night was kind of uncomfortable and probably not very fair.
Yeah, the problem is, you're right, it intuitively makes sense to give the more serious contending candidates more time, but the seriousness and contention of the candidates is to a large extent determined by how much interaction they have with the public via the mainstream media.
Right.
That's the real catch-22 here. And I think we saw first with Michelle Bachmann in a very real way that the media was interested in making her the anti-Romney and following that narrative. You know, it seems like 10 years ago now, but it wasn't all that long ago.
Right.
They kind of created her surge, or at least helped create her surge by giving her all the exposure she could handle. And then they kind of, when they decided they, you know, Herman Cain was coming up, Rick Perry was coming up, they decided that she was no longer the story. And so she's been kind of starved for media attention again. So there's that danger that the mainstream media can create and destroy candidates. And I don't think it's some sort of conspiracy. I just think it's a function of the regular priorities of the average mainstream media TV producer, liberal columnist, beat reporter. One of their big interests is in what Jonah Goldberg's called conservative anthropology. They sort of look at the likes of Herman Cain, Michelle Bachmann, and Ron Paul as gorillas in the mist to be studied academically and shake their heads, you know, at can you believe what these people will say and do? That's one aspect of it. The other aspect, though, is we have to be realists. And you have to say, you know, you go to war with the media you have, not the media you want. So some of this response, especially from Gingrich, Gingrich and Cain do it in very different ways. Cain just, you know, his entire campaign is predicated on believe me about me. Don't believe anything the media or anyone else has to say about me. I'm the only authoritative figure on me and what I believe and what 999 actually says versus what everyone else says it says. And Newt Gingrich is waging war on the media in another way, which is that every single one of his debate appearances has turned into scolding the moderators. Now, I think Pelley, among all of them, deserved it most, especially on the rule of law thing.
Right.
But I'd be a little wary of this. I mean, that's good for scoring with the base, but at the end of the day, the way you get in touch with the American people, for better or worse, is through the mainstream media.
Well, that's true. Although once the nominee is decided, the idea that there's going to be impartiality going down the home stretch in the general election is pretty,
goes right out the window.
Yeah, pretty elusive, I think. I always kind of think of the moderator as a good referee. A good referee is one at the end of the game. You don't even really remember who he was or what calls were really made, just because things flowed well. They didn't make it about themselves. And some have been better than others. Pelley was not good on that front. Anderson Cooper's not good on that front. The CNBC folks, probably a little bit better than most. All of them have a little bit more work to do because a lot of times, as Newt Gingrich mentioned in one debate, the question is longer than the time the candidates have to answer. And that just gobbles up time and doesn't give us a very good idea of what these people really think about the key issues. So.
Right, and they're overcalling all these helmet-to-helmet hits. I mean, let them play.
That's all right. Dan, have a great day. Enjoyed posting all the Bieber stuff, and we'll talk to you tomorrow.
All right, thanks a lot, Greg.
Dan Foster of National Review Online. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Please join us again tomorrow for the next 3 Martini Lunch.